For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Hey.
Hello. Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Testing.
Testing?
Testies.
Testies. 1, 2, 3.
Nah,
4.
Nah, nigga.
I don't know shit about fuck.
Put your balls in time.
I like sucking.
Put that dick in my ass.
Legit fat podcast.
I like China.
Welcome to Costco. I love you.
You are.
Oh,
well, hey, welcome back to Legit Bad. If this is your first time listening, I'm Joe. Jen is with me today. Yay.
Hey.
Oh, I don't even. Okay, I'll just.
Boner.
There, that'll work. Our guest tonight, of course, is Corey Hughes of bloodyhistory.substack.com. In your face, Lindsay, I just did it better than you. And coreyhughes.org, and he is the author of A Warning from History, the definitive JFK book. And what timing did I have getting him on today with the release of all these JFK files? Before we start, though, it is Corey's birthday.
Happy birthday, dear Valen.
And he's 29 today.
Yes.
I confirm that with him. Yeah. I wanted to let everyone know, thanks to whoever did a recurring subscription on the link in the show notes. Appreciate that. Doesn't tell me who it is, but thank you. And just so everyone else knows, you can do it too. And Jen's car just broke down. So, yes, send us some recurring subscriptions.
For the first time in like 15 years, I had to call a tow truck. I was like, oh, I don't know what it's like to have car problems. So what do I do?
It's what cars do.
I just called my friends. I'm like, wait, you don't have a tow truck, so never mind. You can't help me. I have to call someone and pay them.
There's
damn
one
it.
Thing cars are really good at. It's fucking breaking down at the worst possible times.
You know what? It was not the worst possible time.
Yeah.
I had to be grateful. I'm going to be wooey for a second. I was so grateful. I went home on lunch today, which is like 15-minute drive there and back. I had to drive to work on the highway the whole time. My car was being a little weird, but whatever. But it broke down as I was leaving work. And there was a side street right there that was like off in the middle of nowhere. No big deal. It was perfect. Perfect for a tow truck to get to it. It wasn't raining. It wasn't freezing. I had to be grateful because otherwise I would cry and freak out. So
that's, I mean,
I just had to tell myself it's going to be okay.
Anytime my car has a problem, it's like, do I cry? Oh, I can't really. I'm an adult.
You're a dude. I can cry. I'm a chick. I still get to play that card if I want, but I did not.
All right, so I think we've got all the pleasantries out of the way. Let's get down to what we're here to talk about. So I invited Corey on to talk about crypto because he's probably the most knowledgeable with at least with Bitcoin and stuff like that I know of. And I know I've had questions for you in the past, and I still don't quite get it. I'm kind of crypto retarded. So I guess to get it out of the way, though, at the beginning, the JFK files are just a bunch of piss.
Piss!
Yes.
I told my buddy, shout out Nate, I told him if you wanted to really dig into the JFK thing, just to get your book, because you probably have more information there than you'll ever get in those files. And the files, like, they're dog shit. Like, they're
so we have
terrible.
I know they're lying about releasing all of them, because even in my book, one of my friends caught this. I referenced documents that all there was routing sheets where there was no body of the report, right? And those fell under document list number 179. When you look at all of the documents that they're releasing, it goes from 178 to 180. It skips the 179 files completely. And what the fuck?
Well, and yeah, I thought it was funny too, because everyone's like, oh, it's going to be like the Epstein files, just black lines everywhere. It's kind of worse than that. So I always tell people, everyone knows my opinion on Freedom of Information Act requests. I think they're horseshit. If you get it, they're going to give you what they want to give you and nothing more, and redact whatever the juicy parts are. So with this, it was the same type of thing in my mind. I'm like, oh, they could release 80,000 pages or whatever it is. It doesn't mean that they're going to put in their actual black ops or, you know, black parts they don't want you to know about. They're just not. Those are either don't exist, because why would you write down every illegal thing you do? Even though the government does seem to do that. But why would they do that and then give it to us? And it's just like a wild goose chase for people to be, oh, look what they did. Yay, Trump. He released all these files. And
well, they're distracting, too, from the work that people like Corey are doing. So that people are going to turn away from research like that, yeah, and say, oh, well, these are the actual files. I'm going to dig in myself, and then get led on these down these crazy rabbit trails.
So I'm like, I don't care about any of the files that they're releasing at all. The files that I want that they're never going to release are employment, tax, and Social Security records. That's what I want. Because these people involved in the story are not who they say they are, period. Not all of them, but Oswald, his mom, family, couple other people in the story are most certainly not who they claim to be. And so I need to know, I need the whole story and the tax and employment records. Like, I just spent like the last 8 months or so on Oswald exclusively and his childhood, everything up to 1959. Right. And so you would think that I think virtually every document I could find pre 1959 on Oswald. And it is clear he's in multiple places at the same time. And so we need to know the real deal. And the problem is, if they give us real deal tax records, it will contradict the known story. And this is what they're hiding. They're not hiding anything about the assassination. Well, they're hiding everything about the assassination. But aside from that, the real thing that they're scared of getting out is their ways and means and how they operate and their methods of tradecraft. And once people start to understand that the CIA is pulling covert ops in America with everyday families, the shit's going to hit the fan. I mean, I think that's a bigger story than Kennedy. It's obvious who killed Kennedy to me. The whole world knows the CIA was involved, right? and that's all you really need to know. And Mossad, of course, right? But it's all the establishment.
No, I like that. So the hardcore like data points that you're looking for, like with those records, that would be way more, eye opening, I think, than just some statements in a file that said, "Oh, this guy said this allegedly," or "this guy was talking to this guy."
Yeah. That stuff is all irrelevant. The real information is going to seem innocuous to somebody uninitiated. You know what I mean? They're not going to understand what they're looking at, and to me, it'll be like unautistic. Holy fuck. I'll give you one example. The thing that fascinates me the most is Oswald's life from give or take January 54 to July of 56. That to me is like the most fascinating time period for Oswald. Next to like the New York stuff goes on from basically August 52 to January 54. And then he goes back to New Orleans, January 54 till July 56. Really, that kind of 4 year period is like is peak contradiction in the records.
But I've heard you talking about before, isn't there? You said Oswald was in several places at once. Do you think it was like a body double type of thing?
Absolutely, 100%. And I think it was a brother that we don't know about.
So, a twin?
No. Well, here's the thing. We have some obfuscation around the birth dates, right? Oswald's birthday is October 18th. But there are many documents where his own mother wrote his birthday as October 19th. It's weird. It's part of it's some sort of indicator. Like they're sending a signal or something. They're doing, I can't figure it out, but I've come to two conclusions. If I think it's a brother, if the dual Oswald thing is a brother situation, it is either a twin that was separated at birth. Because here's the deal. Marguerite Oswald, his mother, was a total rotten, disgusting, cold-hearted human being. She tried to give her children away as often as could. She had three kids. She didn't want any of them. She stuck them in the orphanage. She tried to give them to the orphanage permanently, and they said no. And then as soon as she could, she sent her other kids off to boarding school. But it was Lee that she seemed to have a lot of affection for. But I forget my point. What was I talking about?
Wait, I just have a question. Can you send your kids to an orphanage temporarily?
Yes, yeah, so she did. She did a lot.
I wish we had known that years ago.
So anyway. Oswald's two brothers, when they turned like 3 and 4 years old, were sent to the three different orphanages, one in Algiers, Louisiana. And then there was another one they were at only for a day or two, and they were told to leave because they didn't like Marguerite. And then they send John Pick, who's the brother, half-brother, and Robert Oswald to the Bethlehem Orphanage. And this is where it gets really, really weird. The Bethlehem Orphanage is a whole... Man, everything Oswald touches is a rabbit hole. And so when you get to the orphanage, his two brothers live there for like 2 years, and then he gets thrown there for about 10 months. December 26th, the day after Christmas, they gave him up to the orphanage, right? December 26th, 1942, all right? And so, but during this time, I know why she gave all the kids up, because she joined the Navy, and they covered this up. This is nowhere in the documents, but when you come to understand the little nuggets that she dropped in, that Marguerite dropped in testimony that she had worked for, it was slipped that she worked for as a phone operator in the Navy in Algiers, Louisiana in 1942, right? You don't just get a job at the Navy, right? You have to join the Navy, right? And so I looked into that era, and it turns out that there was a program called the WAVES program. It was the Women in the Navy program. It was to hire civilians in America while all the actual Navy people were overseas in the war. They had a drastic need for civilian type staffing, but in the military. And so they created the WAVES program. And so there's a video on YouTube. You can go watch it. It talks about the phone operators in the WAVES program. So I'm like, holy shit. So she admitted she was in the Navy, which means she had to have been in the WAVES program, nothing else. She didn't join like, you know, normally. And if she was a phone operator, she had to have a top secret security clearance, because in this video I watched, they talk about how the women in the Navy connect high important people, you know, people high up, and they talk about secret stuff. So you need to be able to keep a secret. And even did that in the video, and I laughed. You know how the 50s videos looked, and the guy talking like this, you know, and so she inadvertently admitted she was in the WAVES program by saying she was a phone operator in Algiers, Louisiana. But she never was in Algiers, Louisiana. When you dig into the addresses in Algiers, Louisiana, they're bad. She never lived in any of them. And so anybody who's ever lived in New York knows that 2136 Broadway and 227 Atlantic Avenue are New York addresses. Okay, so once I realized that those were New York addresses, and the man she was about to marry in 1944, she met in 42, allegedly in Algiers, well, he was living right up the road from her where she was living in New York. So I put together a whole string of events based on little tidbits here and there. But that's why she gave her kids up for 3 years, because she went and joined the Navy. And so why would the government cover that up? Why would the government go out of their way to hide that?
Yeah.
Beats the hell out of me. But where are her Navy records? Do we get those in the JFK document dump? No.
I would assume not.
No. Yeah, they don't even admit she was in the Navy, much less tell us that there's records, right? So, but it's obvious that there are.
With any of these big things that happen, especially something like JFK assassination, there's always somebody in the family who has a military or, you know, contractor, you know, connection to the government. And correlation is causation, but it doesn't make it look good when there's always that connection.
Right, but here's the problem in particular with Kennedy. Every single person involved in Kennedy, except for the younger people, everybody was in World War II. You know what I mean? Everybody was in World War II. They sent half the damn country to World War II, right? And so come 1963, virtually every cop you get, everybody has a military background. You know, so it's kind of hard to discern which ones maintained. And you can even like the CBS reporters who went to go work for CIA and stuff, like even they were in the war, right? And so it's like, Jesus Christ, not everybody was in the war, but everybody who was shady was definitely in the war, because that's how they all met. And they were all like a lot of the guys surrounding Angleton, the OSS, like those Ted Shackley and those guys. Well, he was a little younger, but all those guys really kind of came together during the war. And that's so by 63, you have like almost 20 years of relationships between some of these people because of their intelligence connections, right? Like, there were intelligence connections in Dallas through Cabell, the mayor, whose brother was like the number two guy in the CIA, right? And so there's all kinds of weird, you find out about relationships that just shouldn't exist, but that do. Like Captain Westbrook of the Dallas Police Department will go to Vietnam after the war, after Kennedy, and be stationed with David Morales. You know what I mean? Both of those guys were key in the assassination plot, right? So, but then they end up together in Vietnam. Not a coincidence, you know? So there's a lot of stuff like that. So just having a military background isn't in and of itself damning, but it's pretty damning, you know?
Yeah. It doesn't look good, like I said.
Yeah, but these files are all a joke. Like I said, I want Robert Oswald's Marine record, you know? I know that there are Marine G2 intelligence. That's a G2 is like a Marine intelligence unit they have files on Oswald. Where are those? Do they even tell us those exist? No. The only reason we know they exist because these people are stupid. They release documents that reference other documents. And they were like, well, hey, where's this other document? Oh, we don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And you referenced it, motherfucker.
The thing that pisses me off the most about these kind of like file dumps and all that is it's been so long and everybody's kind of already drawn their own conclusions about what happened, where they can release all this. And even if it were to straight up say, this is exactly who killed and here's all the, you know, records that you want to prove that, 2 days later, everyone would be like, meh. We kind of knew that.
Because whatever. All the people who were in the CIA aren't there anymore. So they'll have a narrative of, well, you can trust us now because we're telling you that these past people lied, but they're not there anymore.
Yeah, we don't do it anymore, obviously. Yeah. We stopped that program.
Or there was an article I read that was, it said that the JFK files they basically lay out the same narrative that we've been told over the years. That was just, it was on like, you know,
well, that's how the media or something is like
that.
It,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. But that's what a lot of people are going to see. That's in the mainstream.
Because nobody's going to read 80,000 fucking files. And even if they could, they're not going to get much out of it.
Even if they did, they're not going to get anything. Yeah.
But you can find way better information on this. I'm assuming you sort your sizes. Wow. Let me take two. You cite your sources in the book and he goes way more in depth to other angles of it too. Like how, wasn't it Purim was the, tiny hat person holiday that was that day and all kinds of
stuff. Well, it wasn't that day. It was symbolic, but that's not one of those things I tend to talk about much because.
Yeah, you lose people at that.
I lose people. You know, you got, that's red belt level conspiracy shit. You know what I mean? Like, so that loses people real quick.
Yeah. So that is what's cool about the book is he's going like, here is a fact. Here is a document to support it. Here's this. Here's that.
Yeah, you gotta ease people in.
I'm finding it. See, the more I get into Oswald, and let me make this absolutely fucking clear: like the story of the Kennedy assassination and the story of Lee Harvey Oswald are two completely separate stories that just so happen to intersect for, you know, give or take a year or so. And so, it was like a collision course, like coming in at different angles like this, and boom, you know. And so, to me, the story of the study of Oswald is a completely different thing, and I'm so much more fascinated by it than the assassination at this point. I mean, because when you study the assassination, you get to a culmination, like, where the fuck was Oswald? He was nowhere. Like, he played no part in the story for me at all. Forget about all the communist stuff that happened in like New Orleans with him handing out the flyers. That was all part of the setup, you know, which is weird because when you look at the timing of it, like once he got back from the Soviet Union in mid-June of 62, he came back because he didn't like the Soviet Union. It fucking sucked. He's like, God damn, thank God I'm out of that place. You know, and he liked being in America and he liked Kennedy and he was just a normal kind of guy. And his family and friends and everyone who talked to him, besides the fact that he talked in Russian to his wife, there was nothing communist going on ever. When they found out that he got arrested on the street for doing the communist stuff, they're like, oh my God, what the hell's, what? They couldn't believe it, you know? And so to me, that's an obvious, he's walking out the door and assuming a role, you know what I mean?
It sounds like a classic Patsy. You said there are two different stories that intersect right around that time. That sounds like a convenient person to take the blame for the rest of history.
Right. But see, they started setting him up back in like 61 when he was in the Soviet Union still. They started going and doing things in the name of Lee Oswald and starting to build this communist persona. But he was still in the damn Soviet Union. Like January 61 at Bolton Ford, a guy goes in using the name Lee Oswald, attempts to get a bunch of quotes for Jeeps to send to Cuba. Okay. What kind of a screw up is that? That's like, that is so easy to determine that he's not in the country, right? So what is that? Is that a screw up? I don't understand. You know, why would they do that? But that setup began long before they could have ever possibly wanted to shoot Kennedy. So why would they do this? Why would they go to all this trouble to create or to perpetuate the legend? Because he already started the legend in the Marines. Really, the Marines is kind of you have a couple one-off incidents of him talking about communism going back to 1953, but really it's not until he gets to Santa Ana, California, in Marine Air Control Squadron number 9. That's where he starts talking communism and listening to records in Russian and like getting Russian newspapers. It was like nothing, no communism, no communism, no communism. And then boom, Santa Ana, and it's all communism all the time. Right. So it was a very distinct point in time that this legend was being created. This is obviously to get him into the Soviet Union, right? This is obvious for his defection scheme. After he gets back, though, he personally wasn't, he was never really a communist, in my opinion. He was just an intelligence asset doing this stuff. But once he comes back, that whole communist thing kind of dies down again until he gets back to New Orleans in April, May of 63, right? So you virtually have a year, almost 10 months or so, where there's virtually nothing communism going on involving Oswald. Like with the person that who got arrested that day and shot by Jack Ruby, that person is not involved in any kind of communist stuff. It is not until after he gets back to New Orleans much later. And so, but the weird thing is you'll catch people setting him up along the way during that time period, saying communist thing, you know, pretending to be him, saying communist things. Like they're creating a legend while he's in Dallas, and he's in Fort Worth. They're in New Orleans, and they're creating this legend around him. You know, then
isn't
he comes
Jack,
back.
Jack Ruby's real name, Jack Rubenstein or Rubenstein.
Jacob Rubenstein. Yes, but his whole family changed their names, but that's not uncommon. You know, Jews change their names very often.
Yeah, like Netanyahu. Oh right. Wait, yeah.
Yeah. What was his name?
I can't remember. He's Polish.
Milachevich.
Though, right?
Yeah, they're all Polish. They're all fucking Polish. Okay. Well, technically they're all Ukrainian, but like the vast majority.
Look, I wear tiny hats now too. Elect me, and they did.
But yeah, back to the documents. The documents I want to see are like what most people would find absolutely mundane. You know, I want to see like his. He had a landlord named Myrtle Evans who let slip one time during her testimony. Doesn't come up anywhere else that she worked for the government in 1942. And that was when she knew Marguerite Oswald. And that's when Marguerite Oswald ends up joining the Navy, right? So I'm like, huh, what the hell was she doing for the government, right? So I want Myrtle Evans' full history and background and military records, right? Like, that's going to tell me more than anything about the CIA, you know what I mean? So,
yeah, this so obviously, you're talking about the you know the slip up of making it seem like he wasn't in Russia at the time. You said, what is that? Is that a big screw? Is that incompetence, or did they just really think that nobody would look this closely into it? You know, 60 years later.
I think that's definitely a factor. Incompetence is most certainly a factor.
And they probably just swept under the rug. They're like, nobody's going to find out, whatever.
Because ultimately, I've determined the person at Bolton Ford and who was mostly in New Orleans doing the setup was Kerry Thornley. There's actually one witness who puts them, Oswald and Thornley, together at the Bourbon House in 63. Only one person. But to me, that was all I needed because I already knew. We have other witnesses, actually, who lived in the neighborhood of Marina Oswald. I forget which, maybe the Neely Street. I forget which address it was, Magazine Street. But they had seen Kerry Thornley over at the house so many times, they weren't sure which one was the husband, Lee or Kerry Thornley. So the connection there between those three is extremely valid. It's valid and it's extremely crucial because he was the one handling Oswald in New Orleans and then posing as Oswald when Oswald was out of town. You know what I mean? So
fucking weird.
Yeah, and he knew Oswald from the Marines. He was basically sent through a course in the Marines that followed Oswald about a year behind him, but followed him. And they had a 2-month overlap in Santa Ana where they actually knew each other. But after they met in Santa Ana, Kerry Thornley goes to Atsugi, Japan. Well, before that, he goes to Biloxi and takes the same courses that Oswald took. Then goes to Atsugi, Japan, goes in the same unit Oswald's in, gets there, starts asking questions about Oswald, and all this is before he allegedly ever found out that Oswald defected to the Soviet Union, right? So why is he asking questions? And he's using an alias when he's doing this. But he's in the same unit. He's taking notes on Oswald. He's taking pictures. He claims it's for a book, but that's just a cover. Because ultimately, he will follow in Oswald's footsteps all the way back to New Orleans. And then he will follow him to Dallas in September of 1963, where he'll continue the setup after Mexico City with Marina. Marina was in on the setup of Oswald from the jump. I mean, I would like to see. That's another thing. There's more documents that are missing, right? So Marina most certainly came back to came to the United States from the Soviet Union, and you think they just like let her walk around, like without being like interrogated at a minimum or documented or having an ankle bracelet or whatever the hell they did in 63, you know, or 62. So those documents are missing. Right. So like I can think of like millions of pages of documents that are connected to this case that I know exist that we're never going to see that are probably not even linked. They're not linked in the JFK files. And if there's millions, I promise you, like millions have been destroyed, like shredded put out to pasture.
Just like the technology to get to the moon. They lost it and now they can't figure it out. So it is incompetence and probably intentional, too. Where's the in your opinion, where's the Mossad connection?
Oh, that goes through the mob.
Which is the government, so.
Right, right. Yeah, it's they're one organization, but the back, but when you come to understand the relationships, yeah, that all started in the 40s in Los Angeles and New York, actually, and Miami, too. So, yeah, it was like a convergence. Let's be realistic. The Jews, particularly Ben-Gurion, sent people here to form relationships with the mob, specifically, like, they didn't just bump into them at the club one day and say, oh, you're in the mob? Oh, you're in government? No, like,
Oh, I thought that's how you got into the mob. Huh.
So Ben-Gurion sent people specifically to meet, you know, Mickey Cohen and Bugsy Siegel and all these guys. And then all the heads of the Mossad and future prime ministers of Israel will end up hanging out with these guys in Los Angeles. So that's where that comes in. But it's entrenched. By 63, it's entrenched. The three organizations, CIA and the Mossad and the Mafia, you can't separate them.
And it explains a lot more since then of things that happened. It's easier to draw lines after you put that together in your head.
Yeah.
Well,
so there's tons of documents on that. It's not in the Kennedy files. It's in the mob files, right? It's in, there's no really batch of Israel. Well, there's some Israel files, but the Israeli stuff you just find connected to other things, you know, everything, right? You go, no matter what you look into, all roads lead to fucking Tel Aviv.
Well, and that's the thing is that they spread out all these connections over so many different areas that, I mean, maybe not intentionally, maybe intentionally, I don't know, but that it would take an autistic person like you to gather all this shit and put it together into a cohesive picture. And people just don't got time for that. So if you want to check out his research on this, and I know you are JFK'd out, you just went on Union of the Unwanted. Was that you? Yeah, you did that, right? Last week? Or
yeah. Did you guys watch that?
No, I have that one in the queue. I have it saved. But
you should watch it because, like, I called out basically them. I was on there with them fools who like pushed the official story. Like a whole bunch.
No
of
way.
Like, oh yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh,
like, all right, we'll have to check. That
I like
out
Don.
For sure.
I like Don Jeffries. Don Jeffries is cool, but all those other guys.
Was it supposed to be a debate, or are they just pushing back?
No, pushing. Okay, man. So I started talking about like the Secret Service car and like the Knoll, and they're like, "Oh no, we don't want to talk about this. We want to talk about how to communicate the JFK Kennedy assassination to the public." And I'm like, you're a bunch of jokers, motherfuckers.
This is a serious research only, people. Corey's very serious. But you can get that. Is it still at buymeacoffee.com/JFK book?
Yes.
I almost said RFK book. Maybe that's coming
soon. And my book's on Amazon. And so.
Oh, nice. All right. Well, I'll put links to that in the notes as well, if anybody's interested in getting that. But yeah, like I said, you're probably JFK'd out and you've spent the last however many years just balls deep in all this stuff. So let's pivot around a little bit to crypto, because I know there's a lot of things going on with it right now. And like I already said, I'm not the guy to talk to you about crypto. I bought some Bitcoin one time. It went up. I made $100 and then I pulled it out and bought silver.
I buy crypto here and there, though. Like I made money off Dogecoin. Like I've told people, I randomly bought Doge the day before people were on, I think it was on Reddit or something. Yeah, when it spiked. But I also just made money on Shiba Inu, but it was it was like a couple months ago. That spiked a little bit too. And then some of the meme coins were going off for a little bit. So I made a little
Trump
money.
The Trump coin
on
went off. I mean, there's millionaires made overnight.
On the Trump coin. I didn't buy that one.
But you just gotta have inside info to know which ones to dump money into.
Tell me your latest thoughts on crypto, because I'm super interested in that too.
Sure. So I'll give you my background in crypto, so I'm not just like some jerk off the street, right? Yeah. So I first got into crypto in 2016-ish. I bought my first Bitcoins at about $575. And
that you're still kicking yourself for today, right?
You fucking got it. and so I ended up making a lot of money over 2016 to 2018, enough to where I could start my business, and I haven't really had a job since. Not a real one anyway, unless you consider what I do a job, which I don't. But I started the first and largest Bitcoin podcast network in 2016, and I worked. I basically was the producer for World Crypto Network, Tone Vase, Jimmy Song, all the guys, anybody in Bitcoin who had a podcast, I managed their podcast for them. And then I went on to become the personal assistant and webmaster for Saif Eddine Amous, who wrote the Bitcoin Standard, which is like the Bitcoin Bible that everyone talks about. And I was his personal assistant for about 2.5 years. And so...
Did you ever meet Bitcoin Jesus?
No, I don't like that guy at all. That guy's a fucking fraud and a hijacker. So we can get to that.
Juicy.
Yes.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with autopay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
At Ritual, we know what goes into the holiday season. The potluck planning, the gift giving, the spreadsheets. So this new year, take a moment for yourself with science-backed support that puts you first. So whether you're focusing on supporting foundational health with a clean vegan multivitamin or supporting your gut health with Symbiotic Plus, do it with 30% off your first month at ritual.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Yeah, so I was there for like, because I was working with, I was the behind the scenes guy for all these media people. And so I was there like every step of the way through all the Bitcoin block size wars, SegWit, Bitcoin Cash, the Craig Wright scandal. Like we would sit when the halving would happen, we would do like 9-hour podcasts and like be like, oh my God, we got the first block in the new fucking halving. It was, you know, it was like we were a bunch of nerds, right?
I was gonna say nerds.
So it was a huge part of my life for a very long time. But my Kennedy research like just trumped everything. It was an overlap of a year or two. And yep, the conspiracy fucks won out, I guess. So
well, I mean, crypto is turning into a conspiracy because you can make anything a conspiracy. You don't even have to try very hard. You just start talking out your ass and boom, it's a conspiracy.
But... Well, let's start at the beginning because people still don't understand what the hell Bitcoin or crypto is. And so
yeah, please tell me because I'm one of those.
Created in the first place. Well, Bitcoin was created in the first place because the 2008 financial crisis showed that printing money at will just does nothing but cause problems, and that Satoshi envisioned a finite supply system where two people could transact and not have to have permission from anybody. And that is basically all Bitcoin is. And that's all it does. It has one function and one function only. That is to be censorship resistant money. That's it. If I have a Bitcoin wallet and you have a Bitcoin wallet, we can send each other Bitcoin all day long. And there's not a single thing anybody can fucking do about it. Right? So obviously you have nodes in the middle and that gets into node politics, which is a whole separate conversation. That's deep nerd shit.
That's holy deep nerd fuck. Shit.
Oh, well, that's the tip of the deep nerd shit iceberg. So, but that's it. That's the only reason Bitcoin exists. So we can transact and not have somebody looking over our shoulder. And why is there a ledger that's public? Well, it's not anonymous. It's really pseudonymous, right? Because everybody can see the transactions that are related to the wallet, but nobody really knows who that wallet is, which gave birth to companies like, I forget what they're called, but there's a big company out there now that can analyze blockchain transactions and see where all the money went and all that stuff.
Oh yeah, and with AI.
Which was inevitable.
Yeah.
But it ultimately was a system that is immutable, that cannot be changed in regards to you can't alter the history. And it provided a level of transparency, right? Now, they're working on things in the second layer of Bitcoin to make transactions anonymous. Like all these other coins that have different functions, one day eventually all that functionality will all be in Bitcoin and everyone else will have wasted their time.
Even like, so I know a lot of people are kind of concerned about privacy, obviously. Monero, is that really a privacy coin? Or is it just...
Monero runs on ring signatures, and ring signatures are an interesting concept. Basically, Bitcoin, you have a transaction and it gets signed a digital signature, which proves it's valid from the previous node transmitter. And so from there, what Monero did was Monero took like a whole bunch of transactions, grouped them together, and gave them one signature for the entire group, right? So that led to some problems. Okay, that sounds like a great solution. Nobody can really trace where money goes because it's all grouped. You might have 250 transactions grouped together with one signature. But the problem with Monero was there wasn't 250 transactions grouped in one signature. There was so little volume on the system that the ring signatures became kind of irrelevant because there wasn't enough data. So what did Monero do? They started filling the ring signatures with fake transactions. Right? So you start to get a little bit incrementally away and create like foundations of sand. You know what I mean? So this is the problem all cryptos have. They realize a problem and then they try to compensate by doing something that's like, are you sure you should have done that? Right? So Monero still works good, but it does until it has enough transactional volume to fill those rings, to fill the rings, then.
Well, you're not going to get that volume with the way it is currently because, A, most people don't know how the fuck crypto works or how to use it. If they do, they're using Coinbase, like me, and using it incorrectly. They don't have their keys on a USB stick or they're not holding it physically. It's on a server. It's in the exchange. So if you're just doing, what do they call, is that EFTs? Is it, wait, EFTs?
NFTs?
ETFs?
ETFs.
ETFs.
Exchange traded funds.
Right. So most people don't hold their own keys. And if you don't, the exchange holds them and that's their fucking crypto if they so desired.
Right. It's like a bank. They take your money and they spend it, but they tell you on the screen you've got $700. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, so.
Well, yeah, 700.
So holding your own keys is the only way to go. It's just a whole security thing. And it's kind of the whole, you might as well just use cash if you're going to have Coinbase hold on to your money. Right. And so that's another thing. People keep asking, like, people want to buy Bitcoin. People want to use Bitcoin to buy coffee and stuff. And I'm just like, are you retarded? Like, Bitcoin is not a transactional currency in that respect. Not yet anyway, because Bitcoin is literally, you're going to see Bitcoin that's worth tens of millions, if not $100 million in your lifetime. And so to spend Bitcoin now on anything is ridiculous. It's like the guy who spent 10,000 Bitcoin on two pizzas back in the day.
Yeah. That guy committed suicide, didn't he?
I don't know, but he's probably broke as fuck right now. You know what I mean? Like, and then you got the guy recently who's trying to buy a landfill because he dumped his hard drive in there like 10 years ago.
And I heard about that. He's like searching through it and shit.
This guy, that one guy, or there's a guy that I heard about who he had lost his password and he had the hard drive. He just couldn't remember his password.
Right. Yes. I remember that he had one attempt left.
There was a podcast about it, but it kept locking him out and it locked him out exponentially. So he was locked out for like, a couple hours, minutes, whatever. And then it was like a day and then it was like 7 days and then it was 10 years.
Oh my God.
And there was a point where he got to, and I think his last attempt is once he does it, he's locked out indefinitely because it's going to be beyond his lifetime that he could possibly unlock.
Imagine
it.
The shaky fingers on that keyboard as he's like,
I just wonder how many wallets that I had that I got that I just let, go away, or I left money on an exchange because at the time it was like $7 or $8 or $10 in Bitcoin and it would have been like $6 to move. And now that's worth like 10 grand,
That's why I leave my stuff in crypto. I have a bunch of stuff spread out in different cryptos and I have Bitcoin too. I just leave it there. I'm like, meh, it's not a ton of money, but it could be someday. There's no point.
Bitcoin is not Bitcoin in particular. Bitcoin, here's the deal. The fundamentals of Bitcoin never change. It's the hype around Bitcoin that you see fluctuate, which impacts price, of course. But the real thing to look at in Bitcoin, and if it's succeeding or not, is transactional throughput. How much US dollars or whatever currency, what is the gross amount of value that's flowing through the system on a daily basis. That's the real value that you can look at, and it's tangible.
Because the price infers usability, or
correct?
What?
Absolutely, it shows how many people are actually using it, you know, and how much it's being transacted. But the more valuable Bitcoin gets, the less people are going to want to transact with it. They're going to want to hold on to it, right? And so that makes it extremely valuable and a very powerful asset, which I don't think most people have really unlocked how powerful it will be. Because Bitcoin eventually will do things like Ethereum and Solana and all the other stuff. Well, some people are purists, and they're like, this is part of the politics, a political conversation. Should Bitcoin remain just a store of value and stay as it is forever, which would be totally acceptable and fine, right? Or should it absorb all these features of other coins, which in turn will congest the network and cause additional problems, which you need to seek additional solutions for, right? So there's a kind of dual mindset. I think it's inevitable, no matter what people want, that it's going to grow and evolve and absorb a lot of other, you know, functionality.
Didn't people have a lot of problem with that last thing that just happened with the block size, or they limited something on it?
Well, there's been I'll explain the block wars over the years and why I hate Roger Ver.
No, that's Bitcoin Jesus, by the way.
Bitcoin Jesus. So Satoshi created 1 megabyte blocks because he wanted the system to be simple that everybody could use, even if you were on a poor device. You know, he didn't want to have gigabyte sized blocks of data because it's not functional. It centralizes the system. When you have too big a block size, too many transactions in one block, you have to go down this transactional rabbit hole, but it does centralize the system using third parties. And that is kind of antithesis to Bitcoin's decentralized nature. And so smaller block size was decided by even the core developers after Satoshi was the way to go, to sustain that small block size and find other ways to scale. This is where Roger Ver comes in. Roger Ver comes into the situation because he wants like gigabyte size blocks, this fucking idiot. He wants huge blocks.
To stop and people out? Like, what would be the reasoning for that?
The reason was because for a time, once Bitcoin started to really get popular, the transactional price went through the roof, the node price. And this gets into node politics, and I don't want to get into node politics, but that's where you got into node politics, because people were saying that the people running the nodes and the miners were exploiting the system and charging too high a fees, which might have been a part of it. But at the same time, the system was congested, and the people who are willing to pay more get their transactions through first, right? So Roger Ver didn't like the solution that the core developers came up with. Now, the people who became the core developers, the guys who gravitated around Satoshi in the beginning, they formed a company called Blockstream. And Blockstream technically is not really the arbiter of the chain, but it's really kind of where the core of development and innovation comes from around Bitcoin, right? So people get mad at them for that because they're like, oh, it's a centralized company that runs Bitcoin.
I was going
to say, right?
If they had a corporate office, it would be that.
Right, but they don't control Bitcoin. They are, and that's another thing. That's because Bitcoin is completely a democracy. You have to submit a Bitcoin improvement proposal, right? And it has to be actually absorbed by the network in order. It's not just voted on yes or no. You have to put it out there. And if people start to use it, and you get a huge percentage of people using it, well, then it's part of Bitcoin now, right? And so that's kind of how Bitcoin works, right? It's basically the users who run their individual wallets and nodes are the ones who make the decisions in the long run. And this is why Roger Ver failed. And how did he fail? Roger Ver didn't like segregated witness. Segregated witness was the solution the core developers came up with to increase transactional flow, okay? And it didn't increase the block size technically. So technically still a 1 megabyte block. But what it did was each block had header and footer data in it, routing information, stuff that had nothing to do with the transaction itself, but various other junk data. Not really junk, but not
just connected. Taking up space.
So they instead of what they did was they cut those out and they gave them their own kind of miniature block space, okay, outside the block of data transactions. And so it was brilliant, and they didn't have to hard fork anything. That was a big concern, because you can't do a hard fork. A hard fork is when you change the code and then you force everybody who has a Bitcoin wallet to update to new software, right? That's a hard fork. A soft fork is when you change the code, but yet it is reverse compatible and works with every wallet prior. Bitcoin cannot hard fork ever. If it ever hard forks.
Fork them gently, people.
Right, you have to get forked gently. You cannot hard fork Bitcoin ever, because that will no longer be Bitcoin. Period.
That'd be a hate fork.
That is, if the guys who have Bitcoin from day one can't send their Bitcoin to this new form of Bitcoin, it's not Bitcoin. So a hard fork in Bitcoin is not something that you can ever do and have any and sleep at night, honestly. And so what did Roger Ver do? Roger Ver came out with something called Bitcoin Cash. And what did he do? He did a hard fork.
And so it's its own thing now, then.
It's its own thing. It's completely separate. But he tried to tell everybody it's the real Bitcoin, and he tried to get the exchanges, the miners, and all the users to recognize his piece of shit as the real Bitcoin. At the time, and probably still today, virtually 100% of the nodes were run centralized on Amazon servers. They weren't run by individual users who gave a fuck. It were run by Roger Ver, who hired a fucking, probably an Indian army to set up a whole network on Amazon servers so he could hijack the coin. So everybody out there who's defending Roger Ver as some libertarian god, go fuck yourself. This guy is a fucking, he's a wolf in sheep's clothing. It didn't help matters much that by forking the chain, now you have duplicate coins. When you fork the chain, you have your original Bitcoins that you had from before on the Bitcoin blockchain, but now you have all of your same coins duplicated on the new chain. So it's rumored that he had a couple hundred thousand Bitcoin at the time that he forked this. So he instantly got a couple hundred thousand of his new piece of shit Bitcoin Cash at the
Did
same
he
time.
Double it? Does that double it, or is it just
it mirrored? Does it's huh. kind of it mirror kind of mirrors it, but it's on a separate chain, so now you have a separate asset that was copied from your first asset,
and they don't interact together. So if
they
someone sells or transacts, it doesn't affect the other.
Correct. It does not. It's a separate chain. They have an identical history to a certain point, right? If you go and you can check the Bitcoin Cash history, it'll show all the way to the beginning of Bitcoin, but at the point of the fork, that is where you have this new thing with a new history. This, you have, when you kind of understand that, and then you look at the technical issues surrounding different forks, you can kind of see how the politics of Bitcoin can get really fucking nerd level really fucking quickly, right? The argument over the big blocks versus segregated witness by Luke Dash Jr., fucking brilliant guy. I'm telling you, the guys who were, I don't know who's working on Bitcoin today. It's probably some of the same guys, but the guys who were working on Bitcoin back in 2015, 2016, 2017 are literally the smartest fucking people on the planet, right? And they actually gave a shit about the fundamentals of Bitcoin. And then Roger Ver just comes in and copies the whole thing and says, hey guys, we got Bitcoin over here now, right? And it was like, fuck you.
It seems like Bitcoin went the way of Apple after Steve Jobs died. Like, it just went kind of down the shitter, and now there's got some buffoons trying to run it.
I have no problem with anything I've seen in Bitcoin since. The core fundamentals and the development have been spot on. I don't have any issues with anything. All the problems that you hear about Bitcoin are people's, it's all the everything else.
Ignorance,
yes. Because people forget. It doesn't even matter if hedge funds and all these people start buying Bitcoin. And that's what causes it to go to millions of dollars, which is what's going to happen. The fundamentals will never change. Never, 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 ever, right? So poor ass people down in Nigeria or wherever the fuck who have a cell phone, because everyone seems to have a cell phone, even in the middle of Africa, they can transact in a currency when their fucking government currency is a fugazi. You know what I mean? So no matter what, that's why Bitcoin exists. It's so two people can transact and not ever have to anyone tell them that they can't. And that's it. That's cryptocurrency in a nutshell. That's the whole reason it exists, period. Everything else you've ever heard is lipstick on a pig.
Yeah.
Basically.
So the problem I always had, though, is that it's value is denominated in whatever currency you're using to buy it. So this is the thing I'm trying to wrap my head around. So you buy one Bitcoin, say back when it was exactly $1. All right, so that's a one-to-one dollar, right? Then it goes up to $10, and then it goes up from there. And now you have $1 worth of Bitcoin that is now worth $20,000. Mm-hmm. So if you want to do anything with that, you cash it out for your fiat currency and you're back to fucking dollars again. Right. So as like an investment, I see where that made a lot of people super fucking rich. But isn't it also possible to gamify this thing? Like you were talking about, like governments buying up mass amounts of this shit to pump the price up and then dumping? Like, is that possible? People that have that much money to be able to do that?
No. Well, it's a yes and no situation. On an individual level, no. There's no one person. Maybe Michael Thaler and MicroStrategy, who have 100-something thousand Bitcoin, but they're not looking to sell. Well, they do sell on a regular basis. They kind of trade to increase their stash, but
they're probably trying to keep the price even by doing that, right?
Right. But here's the thing. Like, this goes back to the fundamentals. Like, if you really care about, like, freedom and Bitcoin as a tool of freedom, the price is fucking completely irrelevant. Completely irrelevant. Because if you're just dealing with someone in Bitcoin, you're going to be transacting in a Bitcoin amount, which, yes, has a fiat currency value. But you're still, all the fundamentals are still there. And you do not have to necessarily change your currency into dollars, period. That was kind of the idea in the beginning, that one day everybody will just use Bitcoin and it'll just be, there won't be a trade out value, right? That's too optimistic, because that's way too optimistic.
Well, that would be like a utopia level shit, and I think maybe that's what they're talking about with that. Right.
But I like this, because you could trade it for, it's like someone trading, I don't know, whatever's valuable to you to whatever's valuable to someone else. Like, you don't really, it doesn't really translate. Exactly. It doesn't translate to dollars. You could be like, I'll trade you two cartons of eggs if you work on my car. It doesn't really matter how much those things cost in dollars.
No, and the value is subjective. Yeah. So yeah, the value is set by the people who agree it's worth that. Like, for in the future, like if eggs are $300,000 a dozen and you have a dozen eggs, you're like, I'm getting a new house.
You could, but I mean, it's subjective though, is what I like that about it.
So in the future, so the Bitcoin, you can look at it as just another layer on the internet, right? There's TCP/IP and SSL, and there's all these different layers on the internet, and Bitcoin is a base layer kind of thing. It has it's a layer on the internet, but it's also, you can build on top of it. And so like Lightning Network is what's called a second layer solution. Lightning Network is a system by which I can say, if I want to do instant transactions, let's say I have a community and we want to do instant transactions, I can take a couple Bitcoin and I lock them in a channel. Okay. So they're locked for until I want to unlock them. Within that channel now, you can transact instantaneously and you can set your own fees or priorities. So you could have no fees at all. Within a Lightning channel, you can, anybody who uses it can transact back and forth. And it's not only, it doesn't take the 10-minute block time, it's instantaneous. You can also implement privacy features without tracking. So second layer solutions are where you're going to find very interesting possibilities for things like privacy, right? You'll be able to fine tune usage. If you want to use Bitcoin for your company, like, but you want to keep the Bitcoin within, if say, this is a bad hypothetical, but say you want to do like a company store kind of situation, right? Where you pay people in Bitcoin, but then they can pay it back to you within your little ecosystem and buy things from you or whatever, how that would work. You can do that, and you can create protocols that would allow you to do that on the Bitcoin blockchain. And with your subset of Bitcoin, that's like locked in a channel, right? So that seems to be, people thought that Lightning Network would be a way to large scale Bitcoin, and it's turning out that's not the case at all. It's not going to be a large scale solution. But the more that I see how Bitcoin is actually operating today, the less I really think that we need much more flexibility than what we have. Let me get back to SegWit really quick. So SegWit, by removing the headers and the footers, it basically expanded the block size. And now they don't call it block size anymore. They call it block weight. And it's kind of measured differently. But it can fit the equivalent of somewhere around 3 to 5 megabytes worth of data in a 1 megabyte block by implementing SegWit.
Wow, so compression or?
I'm not even sure. This is where you get into the nerd level. This is even deeper nerd level shit than I know. Yeah, so it's an absolutely phenomenal system, and it has been absolutely incredible, and it has held up to this day. Transactions, there was something with ordinals, okay? Is that what they're called, ordinals? People started to put, like, autographs on the blockchain and shit and wasting everyone's time and money, and, like, I think they pretty much died off.
Like those nerd coders do in games and shit like that, Easter egg type shit. Yeah,
because you can send a message on the blockchain. People have sent messages on the blockchain. And like you can go
in the
black
market's definitely not using that at all.
I mean, it's pretty easy to see. It's kind of hard to hide, but that caused some congestion on the network, but that's pretty much gone away. So SegWit has held up as a pretty amazing scaling feature, because if I can send Bitcoin right now and it'll get there in like very quickly, and it'll cost me like $1.50, right? So it's working. Bitcoin is doing exactly what it's supposed to do. And so I don't really give a fuck what all these hedge funds and the government with their Bitcoin. All this is going to do is drive up price. But people still haven't seen the pattern in Bitcoin price. Like the first couple drops were 90%, right? It went from $100 back down to like hell, almost a dollar. So more than 90%. But the drops over the time have gotten less and less. 90, and then it was an 80.
Further up every time, too.
Right,
so it's got this weird, like, staircase-looking thing where it's going
Yeah, I remember when Bitcoin was, like, $16,000, and everyone was like, ooh, and now it's almost $100,000.
I should have bought
$100
worth of it at $16,000. Right? Fuck.
So Bitcoin is now at, like, $84,000. It was up to, I think, $107,000 or $108,000 at the peak. But when you go back and you study the previous peaks, they never last, right? And so the pattern that I'm seeing is following the pattern that hasn't changed. We never really had a 60% drop. We had like a 54-ish kind of percent-ish. So I'm expecting Bitcoin really to fall back to the high 50s and low 60s still. But not because something's wrong or because somebody did something stupid or some announcement or the micro events that trigger price action seem to be almost completely irrelevant to the large-scale patterns that form. It's like, if it wasn't this, it would have been something else. You know what I mean? Because the pattern...
But they're part of it, though.
True.
They're part of that pattern.
Right.
It's almost
right.
like something that you can foresee it. They're supposed to happen.
Right, but it's also... It shows the... This is like some large-scale universal shit. It shows that the micro and the macro can be quite opposite. You know what I mean? The micro view...
But they're still predictable.
Reaction. Predictable based on timing, maybe not on the event specifically, but the timing of the event. More
yeah,
than
not the
else.
Event, but the timing in general. Yeah, for sure. What are you looking up?
I'm looking up the Bitcoin price, so we can put it in a visual form here of what. Okay.
Go to
about.
Click on max. There you go. See.
So yeah, there's a decent drop here in 2022, and that was when it went down to like 17, 16, somewhere around there. Yeah, 16.
Right. So look at the very first peak here, right? That first peak.
Right.
I remember. No, back. Keep going back.
Back
that's
here. Back here.
I remember when that peak took up the whole page, like this one did. Yeah. That was the standard by which we looked at everything, and for years. How many years was it? Three, four years before Bitcoin even hit that price action again. You know,
and then
here we go,
up,
and then we go another. Here, jump forward another 3 years, and you're almost at that price action, but not quite. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So from here, jump forward another 3 years. So put it in 2026, and you're probably going to be somewhere around here, which is what? Oh, that's 40,000. That's even low. I was, you know, so the Bitcoin is going down. Okay, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Like,
who knows when? But it's going to follow the same pattern it's always followed.
For the audio listeners, if you could see this graph, so it bumps up. And it goes way down, and then it bumps up and goes down, and then it goes way up, and then down, and then way up. But it always goes up more than it did the last time. Well,
it's like the housing
market.
The housing market rises and falls, but it kind of stays stable with cost of living over time.
But why is Bitcoin so predictable?
Because of the foundation it's built on?
No, because of the halving. you can say every 4 years, the block reward is cut in half. So when Bitcoin launched, you got a 50 Bitcoin every time your computer mined a Bitcoin block, right? Four years later, that went to 25 Bitcoin. 4 years later, it went to 12 and a half. Then it went to 6.25. And now I think it's at 3.125. I think you get
a block reward. How do you mine a Bitcoin?
That's a whole different show.
That's a whole different show. Yeah.
No, okay. But I mean, you can't just set yourself up to mine Bitcoin.
You
right? could.
No, you have to buy equipment. Computers. You have to buy equipment.
Okay, yeah.
And you so here's the problem.
Spend more on computers than you'd get in the first hash.
That's correct. Yeah, that's correct. So I knew a guy, my first exposure to Bitcoin, which really I don't think was my first exposure because I already heard about it, but I met a guy in 2011 whose brother was a Bitcoin miner at the time. And he had just spent like 20 grand on equipment back then.
And that was a lot back then.
It was a lot back then. And Bitcoin, the price is kind of funny because that was kind of the kicker in this story. But a whole bunch of us were sitting around and we ended up talking about Bitcoin for a while. And then at the end of the conversation, we're like, well, how much is a Bitcoin? And the guy's like, about 30 bucks. And everybody in the room looked at each other and was like, fuck, we missed the boat. We all thought, we thought we missed the boat at 30 bucks. Because when you look at like, the only thing we had to compare it to was like a stock. And what were stocks going, you know, stock, if you had a stock and it was 30 bucks, that was pretty good, I think. And so we all thought we missed.
A stock that goes up to 100 grand. Yeah.
Right. So
meanwhile, you were missing the boat by saying you were missing the boat.
Yeah. And I didn't think about Bitcoin again until like 2015. It was like 4 years later. Didn't even consider it, nothing. It wasn't even in my head. And then one day I was walking through my apartment in Denver and I was like, huh, I wonder what's going on with Bitcoin. And I checked it and it was like $215. And I'm like, fuck, I really missed the boat.
Yeah.
And then the following month, it was like, I checked it again. It was like 350. And I'm like, fuck, I super missed the boat. And then a couple months later, I checked it and it was over 600. And I was like, I haven't even begun to miss the boat.
Okay. My brain has missed the boat.
It's time to get on the boat.
Right. And so then and there, I bought a quarter Bitcoin for like 150 bucks. So,
oh, yeah.
Wow.
And then from there, I realized very quickly. Because I got engrossed very quickly. And I realized that if you're just waiting on Bitcoin, you're going to be waiting a long ass time. And I ain't got time to wait. I'm young and impatient. Or actually, I was old and impatient. But, you know, I was like, I'm not waiting for this fucking thing. So I got into the ICOs. And the whole ICO thing was big back then. I mean, like, you could get into an ICO every day of the week. It was wild.
What's an ICO?
An initial coin offering. So all these altcoins were offering their, like, you know, launch, right? And that's a whole other conversation, too. But everyone was trying to compete with Bitcoin then. Our blockchain is better. That was the story back then. That's not the story today. People are
they're all Ponzi schemes now. I mean, like all of them, the Hawk to a Girl coin.
Well,
like,
I think it's the meme coin thing. The meme coin thing kind of, the meme coin thing tells me that people are desperate to invest in anything. They really are desperate for something to make some money on, right? And so that's why I think, and I'll get to this in the conversation, but fucking crypto is having an identity crisis. I think that's the biggest problem right now. There's an identity crisis within the people who use cryptocurrency and what's going on. Because meme coins showed that people will invest money just because they want to make some quick money. They know it's Las Vegas.
In this conversation, you've shown that everybody has a different idea of what crypto is and what it does and how it should be used or how it's meant to use. So when you get, you know, however many billions of people they say are on this planet, all doing that, there's going to be some wonky shit going on.
It's going to be like Idiocracy. They're not going to know all of the in and out ins and outs of what Bitcoin is and what it was meant for.
Saying all those fancy words, drag. Yeah.
But in regards to like, in regards to the altcoin space, I think that it's not a lost cause. I mean, ultimately, there was a lot of conversation whether people were Bitcoin maximalists or whether they were okay with altcoins, but I think it's two different conversations. Like Bitcoin has its own function and nothing else will ever compare to what it does. But I think that crypto can still find its way and have a place. I think really crypto should be used more of as a digital stock, right? If you have a company that wants to fund itself with crypto and that crypto functions as its stock and then it does things like really creates a product or does real world stuff, then I think that's fine. And we've talked about this before. We've been actually working on developing a crypto for like the last year or so that does something that no one's ever seen before, using features that have been out there that have been not utilized properly, right? A very philanthropic endeavor, so to speak. So basically, we're coming up with a token called Independent Media Token, which functions on the Solana blockchain and utilizes a 1% tax on transactions to fund independent media projects. And so ultimately, when you follow out the progression of how it will develop, that's ultimately how it will develop, like a stock. Because as this thing grows and more people become funded by this enterprise, the larger the enterprise will grow, and thus the token value will grow. You see what I'm saying?
How is that used by listeners to like tip a show, or what's the usability of it?
All right, so we took a little different approach, because first off, when you look at the meme coin craze, meme coins do absolutely nothing in and of themselves. The token doesn't do anything.
It's all branding.
It's just branding.
Yeah, it's like someone buying branding. A diamond. It's like, yeah, you're just making it valuable because you're telling people it's valuable.
Right. So
like this girl got famous about spitting on dicks, and now right. she has a meme exactly. coin, and then she pumped and dumped, and now we don't.
Right.
She's in the Bahamas somewhere.
Right. So think of it this way. We implemented a 1% tax on transactions, which means 1% of every time the tokens are sent, it will go to a fund, right? This fund is basically going to function like a venture capital, but philanthropically, right? And so let's use this example. Let's say that people want to help kids with cancer. So you have Kids with Cancer coin, right? And it's backed by, you know, some big name.
Bill and Melinda Gates.
Right. Bill and, yeah, but a good version of them that people like, okay? And so then if people knew that every time they buy and use this currency, that they would actually be funding legitimate healthcare for sick kids, right? People would engage with it just for that purpose, just for the purpose of one, they know they're going to make some money because it's going to grow as the endeavor grows. But also they want to, at the same time, without coming out of pocket, fund sick kids, right? That's kind of the basic principle. We call it something different. We call it a philanthropic coin. Kind of a new category, but this functionality is new to Solana, and most people just use it to put money in their pocket, right? But we thought, what if you took that and actually did something good with it, like fund projects? Like if you guys wanted to make a documentary and you needed $10,000, right? You could submit an application.
It's like
and
a crypto GoFundMe.
A crypto GoFundMe, but that doesn't really cost you anything.
Yeah.
No, because it's funded by trading, so it's kind of a self-sustaining mechanism. Based around the idea of funding independent media.
When is this being launched?
Very soon. We just need a little bit more money, and we need.
So, how do you guys get money? So, all of the you guys get a profit somehow, but you're also funding other people.
So, no, we don't make a profit at all. We get an initial couple tokens for launching the project in the beginning.
Okay,
but we don't get anything back otherwise. We don't get any tokens. Any tokens that come back to us get redistributed. To independent media projects, right?
Awesome. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's an incredible concept. No one's done anything like it. People have just taken that tax money and put it in their pocket. And that's where we saw an opportunity to do something really good, especially for our own community. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah.
So we've already got support from 16 shows, you guys, obviously. And we've got Last American Vagabond. And
oh, that's big.
And we got Charlie
Ryan over there.
Yeah, we got Charlie and Macro Aggressions. Rebunked. We got a whole bunch of people. Nice. So, yeah.
Did you get Sam on board yet?
Sam and I still need to have a sit down powwow kind of situation. But like, I'm absolutely interested in Sam getting involved. But we're still kind of keeping it very low key because so when you launch your own token, we've already spent a lot of money on this thing. We built our website out. It's imt.network. If everyone wants to check it out, IMT India Mike Tango imt.network.
I'll put that in the show notes. Hang on. IMT dot what?
Dot network.
Dot network. Okay.
And so we're currently raising money for the liquidity pool. When you launch a token, you have to go to an exchange and you have to give them, we're going to put up 300 million tokens initially. We need to put up somewhere between $5,000 and $7,000 in Solana to balance out the trading pair. Okay. So we're still in the process of privately raising money to launch the liquidity pool. That's it. We're close. We've got around $4,500 right now. I really want to have closer to 7,000 before we launch. Because what happens is you have bot traders who see new tokens and they come in and they just play that game. And if you don't have a solid liquidity pool, you're going to get wiped out. So we need to raise a sufficient amount of money to make sure that we're not affected by bot traders, ultimately, is what we're kind of worried about. Once we do that, we're good to go. And once it launches and we have some money in hand, we will have money for marketing and sponsorships and all kinds of stuff. So
that would be the second big problem, is getting the word out about it, because that's why the meme coins work so well. They're taking a market that already has millions, if not billions, of people tuned into it and going, how do we monetize this? It could be a couple cents a person. Let's send it out. At least this many people know about it. And then boom, all
and
of a sudden.
And it's doing something good. It's not for nothing.
Right.
Which is what all the meme coins are. I totally agree.
Right, they do absolutely nothing. Nothing whatsoever. And
they
here's another
one person a lot of money.
No, it is branding.
Like, and all those people can disappear overnight. Nobody knows who those people are, right?
Oh yeah.
We have a full team of advisors and a core team with names and faces on our website. We're not going anywhere. I'm a very public person. It'd be very hard for me to rug pull anything.
Well, I mean, you used to be a cop, so.
That's good. I was going to say, how would you prove it to everyone that you are actually doing, you know, you're not like United Way,
right,
saying like, please donate a dollar to the kids with cancer. You're not, and right, again, you're not really asking for money. You're just asking for them to transact with that. But,
right,
you know, and you never know.
Thing. One thing that we've learned about the meme coin market is that there's a large enough pool of people who engage with new coins that it'll get us off the ground.
For sure.
Yeah, I wouldn't even worry about it.
Yeah.
So before we get out of here, though, I wanted to, and I'm personally kind of sick of talking about AI. I just wanted to know how that comes into the conversation with crypto, because there seems to be more and more uses for AI. And if you could, I mean, if somebody, I'm sure somebody's already tried or doing it right now, but incorporating AI into all these new meme coins, something that watches new ones or, you know, watches, can do predictions on the fluctuations and all that. Is that already happening, you think? Because it would seem like it would.
I mean, they've had trading bots for years that analyze patterns and stuff. So AI,
I know, like, but with like DeepSeek, the new Chinese thing, like that's actually, AI is getting to another level. Probably by the end of the year, we're going to be like, wow.
So
no, I know. I said that because I know exactly what you think about AI, and it's fucking retarded.
It's a little retarded.
It's good for the things it's good at.
Right,
and one of those things is something like that with crypto, where it can like scour everything. And that's one thing it's good at. It's like an autistic kid. It's like, oh, I can see all these numbers all at once and feed you something.
I can see the
patterns
quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll agree there. And it's good for, I mean, it's weird how it comes up with music. Like, you can put in, write me a techno song with,
it's not,
you know,
great,
about big titties, and it'll write
gonna,
one.
It's only going to get better.
It'll write one because it's pulling from what's out there, and it's recognizing a pattern. What's popular? What's happening? What are people doing? What are people listening
Woo-hoo,
to? What is the biggest
titties.
Download?
Yeah. That was Lindsay, not AI, but yeah. No, yeah, it's not creating itself really as much as just amalgamating a bunch of shit humans already made. But as far as pattern recognition and, you know, numbers and all that, it seems like crypto would be a great space for AI to do some damage.
Yeah, it could. It definitely could.
Well, they had AI making money on sites.
There's AI fucking personalities, fake people that are making money on Instagram.
And they made like 40 grand in a couple weeks or something.
And I wish I would have thought of that. I would have made a fake like chick on Instagram to make a bunch of money. They're actually making money on a fake person. It's just AI.
Okay.
Fucking crazy.
AI just weirds me out. It's something that makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up.
It's uncanny valley.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I always talk about this, but like, I asked it about a Fish album, and it made one up out of thin air. Thin air. I went and saw Fish for the New Year's celebration back in 99 to 2000, right? And it's called Big Cypress. That was the event, Big Cypress. And so I asked it if Big Cypress was released on official DVD or whatever. And it gave me like three paragraphs explaining how it was released and when it was released and all
just
the shit.
Right out of its
talk
AI
right
ass.
Out of its ass. Right out of its ass.
When was this that you asked it that?
Like six months ago.
Oh, wow. Because we.
Which one was it? Was it GPT or?
No, it was I think it was just Google's AI.
Oh, that's garbage.
So we, yeah, like one of the podcasts we listened to were, they were trying to Google books about a certain subject, and AI sent back a ton of books with tons of authors, and they went and actually looked up these authors and books, and it turns out none of them were real. It just made up books and authors.
See, I can't, the paranoid conspiracy theorist side of me thinks that like that's their way of rewriting history.
It could be, yeah.
I mean, they could have been doing it forever. Maybe they're just now releasing AI to us to just play with. Like, come on.
That would be glorious for them. They're, if they could do that, because there's a lot of people that use AI that just don't question it. They're like, oh, it said this is what it is. I'm going to go live my life like that now, instead of like double checking with a lot of other sources. So, and there's enough of those people out there where this could have a devastating effect. You know, more than media already does.
Or the recipes for apple pie where they're like, arsenic. Yeah, just put some glue, arsenic, and gasoline in it. It'll be so good.
And those ones, I'm actually pro that, because if you're that retarded, make that pie. Please. Take yourself out of the gene pool.
I feel like AI is slowly trying to like weed people out just by doing that.
Yeah, just little things here and
they're
there.
Like, we're not going to kill people the way the Matrix portrayed it. We're going to make it way more insidious. Subtle.
Yeah.
And like, didn't AI like make up its own language to talk to each other? Like,
there's all kinds of crazy shit like that. Like, there's something going on behind the scenes. Skynet is happening, people. We're going to all be taken over by machines soon. And I, for one, am here for that. Let's see it. Let's switch it up. Let's shake this bitch up. Fuck the asteroid.
Down for the adventure.
Let's get taken over by Skynet and see what happens. That'd be an exciting future.
It might be short.
Oh, it's going to be super short, but it'll be fun while it lasts. Better than an asteroid. That's not even fun. That's just like, uh-oh, death, and then you're dead.
So, did you guys see that stuff about the pyramids?
Yeah, so I was gonna bring that up. I wasn't sure if you'd heard about it, but that
was it. Real or is that real or psyop? I wonder.
I don't know. So it was the Reese Report. Greg Reese, I think is his name, and he's not like a kook. I mean, you know, as kooky as any of us, but he seems to be a decently intelligent person. And he put out this video that everybody's been playing. If you want to look it up, go. I think it's ReeseReport.com, but. Yeah, what do you know about it? Because I've heard that same report like three times today.
I saw that video like as soon as I got up this morning, and I was like, not his, but another one. It was like, it's pretty wild.
Yeah, so it's weird shit.
So what is it? Because I missed it. I did not have time. I was listening to OBDM. I think they were about to cover it.
They do cover it.
Yeah. I got to work, and I had a weird day, you know, car stuff. So let's
There's like
it.
These weird cylindrical structures that go down like 2 miles or some shit underneath the pyramid. Like they're the top of like an obelisk.
Did they ride them down to see where they go?
They hit them with sound waves and they map the whole thing, and it goes like further.
That's the thing, is you're using something called SAR, synthetic aperture radar, I think they call it, and they apparently from satellites and shit. And who knows? Like, it's too early. I'm not even have an opinion on it yet. That'd be awesome if it was real, but I don't fucking know.
So are they trying to get down there to see what it actually is? Are there teams out there?
I don't think the Egyptian government's going to let them do shit unless there's
no fucking way they are.
Why doesn't the Egyptian government do it, though? I mean, I wouldn't even mind if that happens. I just want people to go see what that is.
They're probably Jews.
No, because
these are the real Jew tunnels. Is that what you're saying?
The real Jew tunnels under the pyramids.
Even for mainstream.
That's where they start. They end in New York. Okay.
Even for mainstream Egyptologists or archaeologists to admit that that could be possible upends like so many years of their mainstream narrative on Egypt history. So,
all right, where's fucking Lara Croft when we need her?
Yeah. Did a bunch of black slaves build those things under the ground too?
Oh yeah, with ropes and pulleys and logs. Yeah, sure. That's how it's all built. I don't know. I'm going to keep up on that though, and if it fades away like a fart in the wind, then it was probably fucking nothing, or they did a bang up job covering it up, and we need to look into it more. That always seems to be the outcome of these things.
Yeah.
Well, Corey, thank you so much for joining us. We'll let you go enjoy
your birthday
in peace and bong. And we'll have you back on soon, especially if something crazy happens in the market or anything. If you if you notice any other trends or anything, hit me up and we'll get you right back on so we can talk about it.
Are there any other coins that you'd recommend besides Bitcoin?
This is not financial advice.
Well, not for fundamental reasons. Meaning like I don't like something because it does something different or cool or anything like that. There, if you like privacy stuff, there is one that's interesting called Krypton, CRP, and it functions on a completely different system. It has a blockchain, but it's completely run off of server. I can't even explain it. It runs off of various types of servers in different ways.
Is it run off like VPNs or something?
No, I forget exactly how their algorithm works, but they have a full interface that you can go and download that has like chat groups and news and like 100 different features built into their framework. And it's an anonymous coin. It's killer, but this hasn't done anything. I've been following it for like goddamn years and it hasn't really done much.
Is it one of those coins that's like 0.00000008?
No, it's like 30 cents or something like that.
Oh, I could afford one of those.
I think it's really good. And I think if people knew about it, it would be used. But, you know, just because something's good doesn't mean it's going to go up in value.
Yeah,
but fundamentally, sure. When I look at Solana, Solana fucked up because here's the problem with Solana. And I'll try to make this really short.
Oh, no worries.
Solana was made such a good blockchain system. It was so good and so efficient. It basically is a system that can simultaneously process multiple theoretical blockchains at once. Instead of coming up with one block at a time that it fills, you know, it fills these blocks up, it can do stacks of blocks at a time. It's going to give you a visual of it. So it's very efficient, and it's so efficient that you could create a coin on it very cheap, like a couple hundred bucks. And that's what opened the floodgates to all these meme coins, right? Because
anybody can now.
Back in the day, even a year or two ago, you dropped a couple grand to mint a coin on Ethereum, you know. And so Solana comes out, and it's such a good system that, well, it's gone offline a couple times. It's got its issues. But as far as the fundamentals and how it's supposed to work, it's really kind of amazing what they did. But it's so good that the price, you create something so cheap that everyone created their shitcoin. And that's what opened the floodgates for meme coins, because it was such a good system. But Solana as a whole, if it can over time transition to better projects, I don't see why you can't have $1,000 Solana, where today it's like 120 bucks. So I think Solana, I think long term Solana is a winner, probably to the point where it's going to replace Ethereum on a lot of stuff. Ethereum is down in price big time.
All right, I thought Ethereum was like the silver of standards.
That's the thing. When you go back to like 2014 or so, when they started coming out with other coins, really, and everything was Bitcoin silver. Everything has had its moment of being Bitcoin silver. You know what I mean?
Most of it's tin.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Tin, exactly. So, but no, I think so. And I think long term, if you're looking to put some money in something long term, Bitcoin is the way to go. There's no alternative. You're going to see that we can't even put a price. There's no top on Bitcoin. It can go to infinity. Well, not technically. It could absorb a vast majority of the world's assets. So,
yeah. Well, and this is another show too, and we'll end it here, but the so-called quantum computing, which I'm not sure I buy into, but whatever they're calling that, the Willow chip from Google, these kind of ideas, that's going to be used in conjunction with AI, and shit's about to change, I think. We probably won't see it for a while, but that kind of back-end shit is... there's going to be some shit going on.
I feel like what Corey was talking about was already sounded like quantum computing, to be honest. But
there is already a debate over this quantum vulnerable blocks is the latest chatter that I've been peeking in on. And so, yeah, there's a whole big political debate surrounding these quantum vulnerable blocks right now. So,
well, maybe we'll do some research on that, and we'll have you on next time to talk about quantum computing, even though nobody knows what the fuck quantum is. And if you say you do, you're full of shit.
It has something to do with opening portals to the netherworld, I'm convinced. So,
it has something to do with entanglement.
Something to do with
you
CERN.
Touch something here, it affects something over here.
Yeah, the idea that we could actually harness that power of the universe to me is fucking crazy.
I'm not putting it out of the realm of possibility. I'm just saying I'll believe it when I see it, so...
fair enough.
But I might see it at the end of a cyborg's gun or something, but that'll be at least like, whoa, it was real. Awesome.
You get to have that last thought. Neat.
Yeah, my last thought. Oh, we were right about it. Huh? And that's how we lost Joe and Jen, or at least Joe. Well, thanks, Corey. Corey hates outros and intros, so I do it for him. CoreyHughes.org or bloodyhistory.substack.com.
Yep.
And get his book on Amazon. Or buymeacoffee.com/JFK book.
And you can buy my new set of notes. I did a 5.5 hour presentation on Oswald pre-59. And I have my notes are 433 pages and they're available for sale.
Nice. So I like handwritten?
No, my slideshows that I do.
Oh, okay. I wanted to see Jesus. Some like coffee stains and jizz stains.
Like, I want it to be legit like 1942. I want it to be in cursive.
Did you write in calligraphy?
Yeah.
Well, thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you guys next week. Also, go listen to Tub Turkey Podcast, my buddy Murph. Mwah! All right. Bye.
Thank you for listening to Legit Bad. Please address all content grievances to gofuckyourself@yourmom.com. See you next week.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.